You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, April the 18th. Yesterday morning when I came into work following the worst mass murder in U.S. history, when a student in Virginia at Virginia Tech University, armed with two guns and a vest full of ammunition, went on his rampage, killing 32 students, staff, and faculty before killing himself on Monday, I had an email from a gun rights group claiming that the ban on concealed weapons on most college campuses, including this one, was in part to blame for all the carnage. The group argued that an armed student or professor could have prevented the shooter from killing so many people, or maybe even stopped him from his plan entirely. Virginia allows concealed weapons, but not in schools or on college campuses. Should concealed carry laws be extended to a campus, or should they be gun-free zones? And would stricter gun control laws, perhaps that ban on assault weapons, for example, certain weapons, for example, or stricter background checks, should those be passed to prevent similar acts in the future? Well, we will hear from both sides of the now reignited debate over gun laws this hour, and we will welcome your views and questions. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. We have with us first John Lott. He is the author of a number of books, including More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws, The Bias Against Guns, Why Almost Everything You've Heard About Gun Control is Wrong, and his newest book, out next month, is Freedomnomics. And John Lott joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure.
So, what is your take on the specific question as to whether if Virginia, the campus, allowed concealed weapons, that this may not have happened?
Well, I think if you look at the multiple victim public shootings that have occurred, they consistently seem to be taking place in these gun-free zones. I think there are a couple issues here. One is, what can you do to deter these people? And if the attacks still take place, what can you do to try to reduce the severity of the attack? And I think in both cases, allowing people to have the option or possibility to defend themselves can have an important impact. Bill Landis at the University of Chicago and I looked at all the multiple victim public shootings in the United States from 1977 through 1999. And what we found was that the normal things that affect crime generally didn't have any impact on multiple victim public shootings. The main thing was law enforcement, higher arrest rates, higher conviction rates, longer prison sentences, the presence of the death penalty. Just weren't relevant, and there's a simple reason for why that's the case, and that is virtually always, or a very high percentage of the time, the people who commit these crimes die at the scene. They either are killed by someone else with a gun, or they commit suicide. And so the normal type of law enforcement that you have to punish people, where you punish people after the fact, simply isn't relevant for a huge percentage of these guys, and probably even many of the ones who end up not dying. Interviews and other things afterwards indicate that when they went in, they expected to die, and it was only because they just couldn't bring themselves to commit suicide or something at the end that prevented that from happening. But what you find when states pass these right to carry laws, there's about a 60% drop in the rate at which these attacks occur, and about 78% drop in the rate at which people are killed or injured in these attacks. But even more important is that to the extent to which these attacks still occur, they tend to overwhelmingly take place in these gun-free zones.
Yeah. So it's thought that someone like this student would say, nobody else is allowed to carry guns, so therefore I'll shoot people?
Well, I mean, I understand the desire to try to create a safe area, and it's surely a normal reaction. But you look at some of the things the Columbine students, for example, were very conscious of the fact that the state was considering a right to carry law. One of the students actually had been writing the state legislature there trying to oppose it. And there's some evidence from the notes that they have that they may have decided to go ahead and do it when they did, which was the day that the state legislature was finally going to be voting on the bill, because they wanted to do it before there was any possibility of somebody having a concealed handgun around there. I understand the desire to try to create a safe zone, and the idea is that if you just ban guns, you'll do that. The problem is, who obeys these rules? Who's more likely to be affected by the ban? And you look at some place like Virginia Tech. Students are expelled even if they had a permit to carry a concealed handgun every place else in the state. If they were to bring it with them on campus, they would be expelled. Faculty risk being fired if they do that. And those are big penalties for those people. But for this guy who's committing all these murders, what difference does it make if he's expelled? I mean, the penalties, and even if you look at K through 12th grade, where you have prison sentences for people who violate the gun-free, 1,000-foot rule that you have around schools, a 3-year prison sentence for you or some other law-abiding citizen becoming a felon would completely alter your life in really amazing ways. But for somebody who's already going to be facing multiple life sentences or multiple death penalties, it seems pretty big stretch to think that additional penalty is going to be somehow going to make the difference for them, whether they're going to go and commit the crime. And what you end up doing is, rather than creating safe zones for the victims, you unintentionally make it so that the criminal has less to worry about. And just one thing to think about. If you were going to have somebody stalking you or your family, do you think that you would feel safer putting a sign in front of your home that said your home was a gun-free zone? Do you think that would make it more or less likely that somebody would be willing to attack you and your family?
We will let people think about that over the weather break. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, 19 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, April the 18th. We're talking about the gun law debate that has been reignited now following the tragedy at Virginia Tech University on Monday. Gun rights folks are weighing in. Gun control advocates also weighing in. We're hearing from both sides of the issue during this hour. We'll go to the phones. 1-800-642-1234 is the number you can use to join our conversation in Madison, 263-1890. We're talking with John Lott, who is the author of a number of books, including More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws. Dwayne in Hayward is our first caller. Hi, Dwayne. You're on the air.
Good morning, Joy. Yeah, I'm a 30-year law enforcement veteran, and I lay the blame exactly on the Virginia legislature and university officials who didn't allow any of these students the right to defend themselves. Police response time is anywhere from seconds to minutes to hours, depending on which part of the country you live. When you have a person that is absolutely insane like this party was and is willing to die, only the people there at the time are the ones that are going to be able to stop them. Waiting for armed police officers to get their armed military to get there in some countries just doesn't work. people should have a right to defend themselves and a right to carry.
Yeah. Well, that's what you think too, John Lott?
Yeah, no, I think one of the, I think it brings up excellent points. One of the things that we find that helps explain the how many people are going to be killed or injured in these attacks is the amount of time it takes between when the attack starts and when someone's able to arrive on the scene with the gun. The longer the amount of time, the more people you're going to have harmed. And being able to have someone present there, I mean, how many students... How many faculty members did this person come into contact with? You know, you're probably talking about hundreds. And, you know, even if there's only, you know, a percent or two chance that any one individual would have been able to have a gun, someone who's unknown to the attacker there, the probability it would have been near 100% that he would have run into someone well before the police were able to arrive there in order to stop it.
Yeah, but... Do we know how many more boyfriend-girlfriend disputes would end in death or other such things if
sure
students
we
were carrying guns around campus?
Sure we do, mm-hmm. Because we have about 5 million Americans right now who currently have active permits to carry concealed handguns in the United States. We have states that have had these laws for as long as 80 years. There are many states that keep very public, detailed records on the behavior of permit holders. You can go to Florida, for example. The Concealed Carry Division there has detailed information that indicates that between October 1987, when they started the right to carry law there, and the end of this last year, they had issued about 1.4 million permits to different people. Some of those lasted 5 years. Some were renewed multiple times. But out of that 1.4 million, 156 permits were revoked for any firearms-related violation. Almost all of those firearms-related violations involved just one type of violation, that was someone carrying a gun into a restricted area, a gun-free zone, like an airport or a school or something like that. And, you know, they didn't do any harm or anything. But even that whole 156 represents, you know, about a hundredth of one percentage point of the permit holders. And you can go to the Department of Public Safety in Texas and look at their website, and they'll also show very similar results for the behavior of permit holders. Florida's permit holders, it's possible to compare it even to off-duty police. Off-duty police in Florida are arrested at a higher rate than concealed carry permit holders are in the state of Florida.
Let me ask you on another issue. The guns that were purchased by this shooter, Sung Wee Cho, one was a .22 caliber Walther P-22, whatever that is. The other was a 9mm Glock 19, a semi-automatic. He also bought 50 rounds of low-velocity MagTech target ammunition. Should we be selling, say, semi-automatic guns like this to anybody? Who isn't that one of the reasons why so many people ended up dead in this? Is that he was able to fire off so many rounds so quickly?
Well, the vast majority of guns sold in the United States are semi-automatic. Semi-automatic means that you have one bullet leave the chamber for each pull of the trigger. And I suppose the alternatives, would be to have some type of gun where you'd have to load manually a bullet in each time you were to fire it. I mean, people probably have seen breech action rifles or something like that. There's costs and benefits of having all sorts of different types of guns. People who would be using guns defensively would find it difficult to go and defend themselves also if you had a gun where you had to go and load somehow each bullet each time you were going to fire it. But pistols, whether they're revolvers or semi-automatics, they essentially reload each time you go and pull the trigger. A new bullet moves into the chamber at that point. And, these are technologies that have been around for a long time. These are not particularly high-tech guns. These are the guns that this person used were some of the simplest guns available.
Yeah. So the reports I heard that one of these guns might have fallen under the ban on federal, the federal ban on assault weapons. That's not true.
No.
Yeah. All right, Tom in Hudson. Hello, you're on the air.
Is that me?
Yes, it is you.
Yeah. Your guest solution is to this tragedy: more guns, arm every teacher in the country. Okay. Now, quick statistic. Canada, the whole country of Canada, 32 million people have less murders than the city of Philadelphia with 1 million people, which is the murder capital of the world. What is wrong with this picture? I mean, don't you get it? It's sane regulation. Why don't we just let everybody have a bazooka? Then we'll be real safe, right?
Right. Well, you have about 75% of the murders in the United States are concentrated in about 3% of the counties. You can look across the United States, there's huge variations in the murder rates. 50% of the counties in the United States have zero murders. Another 25% of the counties have one murder in any given year. Those just happen to be the places in the country which have the highest gun ownership rates. But, you look across the world. You look in Europe, for example. Which country has either consistently the lowest or one of the lowest murder rates in Europe is Switzerland, even though Switzerland has a gun ownership rate that's about 25% higher than the United States, 25 percentage points higher. Probably the country in the world with the highest gun possession rates is Israel. Yet Israel has traditionally had one of the lowest murder rates in the entire world. But, even more important, if you look at over time, countries before and after they change the different types of gun regulations, what you find is that murder rates in those countries and other violent crime rates rise after they restrict gun ownership. Britain, for example, after they banned handguns in January 97, has actually seen a doubling in gun crime in the country over the next 5 years. It's very difficult to go and keep criminals from going and getting guns. The big problem that you face, whether it's these gun-free zones or other types of gun regulations, is that it's very often the most law-abiding citizens who are going to be obeying these laws, who are going to find it more difficult to own one or are going to be disarmed relative to the criminals. And if you disarm law-abiding citizens relative to the criminals, you can see increases in violent crime rates.
Yeah, we only have a minute to go. I'm wondering if you can summarize how you think where this debate's going to go following this shooting on Monday.
I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of frustrated myself with this debate. I've been making this argument for a number of years, but I hope people begin to ask themselves whether it's in Europe, where there have been a number of multiple victim public shootings, in Germany and France in the last 5 or 6 years, or other countries in Europe, in the United States, where have these multiple victim public shootings occurred? And what you'll find is that they consistently take place in these gun-free zones.
Yeah. Well, we will leave it there. We'll, I'm sure, talk more about this in the future. Thanks a lot for being with us. John Lott is the author of a number of books, including More Guns, Less Crime. We'll get another side of the issue after the news. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 7:36 now on this Wednesday, April the 18th. And we will continue our discussion in this half hour, getting a different perspective on the gun law debate that has been reignited following Monday's killings at Virginia Tech University. We heard from a gun rights advocate in our last half hour, and we will now hear from the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence in this half hour. And we'll continue to welcome your views and questions at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Let me welcome in Josh Horwitz, Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. Well, we heard John Lott in our last half hour saying that gun-free zones on college campuses, schools, other places, Virginia Tech, a gun campus is a gun-free zone, are where most of these multiple victim shootings occur. And that if students and faculty are were allowed to legally carry firearms, that this could have been prevented. What's your take on that?
Well, I think the biggest multiple shooting zone in America is our streets. We have, you know, thousands of handgun homicides every year, suicides, et cetera. You know, this is just, I think, a symptom of a practice that makes it much too easy to get firearms. You know, there's just no evidence that the gun-free zone makes things more dangerous. In fact, I think it's very clear that the problem here is guns in those societies in these areas. I don't think having, you know, concealed carry holders or permit holders or students carrying guns or teachers carrying guns are going to make these schools any safer. It takes a lot to respond credibly with a firearm. It takes a lot of training to be able to do that. And I think that the impulse to keep guns out of our schools is a good one. And I think, you know, the research is very clear that the more guns in an area, the more dangerous it is. That goes at the local level and at the state level. And I think that guns, you know, guns, and of course, because they act, they allow people with mental illness, et cetera, criminals to do terrible things, that they make situations much more dangerous. And I think the research is very clear on that.
Yeah. What would you like to see, Josh Horowitz, in terms of stricter gun controls that would have made any difference at all on Monday?
Well, you know, I work on a much larger scale than that. I mean, this is a terrible, terrible killing, but you have to look at, I don't decide policy based necessarily on one event. I mean, you have to look at what is going on across America. And then try to make some, you know, policy decisions based on that, or not. I mean, sometimes there's no solutions to these things. I'll tell you though that since the assault weapons ban has been, you know, let to expire in 2004, we've seen a lot more powerful weapons on our city streets, in our streets, and a lot more high capacity magazines. And I think that, you know, this Mr. Wee used obviously a high capacity magazine that he would not have been able to buy before 2004. That's one. I mean, I think the other thing is that Virginia has the very basic of background checks. We need to increase, you know, enhance our background checks, and we need to do, you know, to move towards more of a Massachusetts, California, you know, New York style background check and licensing registration. States that have done a wonderful job are working hard to, you know, reduce the incidence of illegal gun trafficking, I think, have done a good job on this. And I think this just sort of underlines the weak gun laws in the United States. I mean, I think people are just sort of, a lot of people are appalled that you can just slap down your driver's license and get a gun in 2 minutes. I think if the most cursory inquiry had been done, this young man would not have been able to get a gun. And here he is getting two guns, high-capacity magazines, and tons of ammo. That just doesn't make a lot of sense.
We have lots of callers, so let's go to Mark in Spring Green. Hello, Mark.
Hey, good morning, Joy. Listen, I'm making quick 58 years old. I've hunted since I was 14. I think I own 15 guns, and not one of them could I walk across a college campus without somebody saying, holy crap, that guy's got a gun. I'd like to know the difference. I'd like to know the statistics between long gun homicides and suicides versus handguns. To me, the problem is simple. It's handguns. It's highly concealable, very powerful, semi-automatic weapons with large magazines. And I look, you know, I think to myself, what good is this gun? I love guns. I love to hunt. But the thing is, what good is a handgun? To me, it only has one purpose. And just about every one of these large shootings involves handguns. Eric Hainstock killed John Klang with a handgun after the long gun had been taken away from him. So, I mean, to me, I used to be a member of the NRA way back in the 70s when they took a stand in favor of Saturday night specials. That was it. I've no longer been a member, and I just think we need to draw a line in the sand and eliminate some of these guns that are highly concealable and very powerful.
Thank you very much, Mark, for the call. Mark was citing a case where a student in Wisconsin shot and killed a principal recently,
right,
in a school. Josh Horowitz?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to argue with him. I thought that was an excellent point on a number of fronts. First of all, the vast majority of gun crimes and murders in the United States are committed with handguns, upwards of 80%, and exactly because they're highly concealable with and more capacity and more caliber strength. So if you're looking to impact crime, reducing the access to handguns is a really good place to start. Long guns just are not as useful for crime for numerous reasons. I think the other issue that's very interesting, and I've heard this over and over again in the last couple of years, is that people, hunters, are becoming very disillusioned with the NRA. The NRA has really sided with the sort of the fringe elements of the gun culture, people who really are interested in, almost overthrowing the government. They don't care about public safety at all. I call them the insurrectionist crowd. But they also, I think, committed the cardinal sin of signing on with the developers and the land grabbers and people who want to get rid of public lands for hunting. And, of course, the public lands are shrinking, and the NRA has sided with the polluters and the developers and the land grabbers and the clear cutters. And, they have, for instance, don't support the roadless initiative. They would like to roll back that so we can put roads in national forests. And, of course, once comes roads, then comes the loggers. They get the destruction of the habitat. So, this is something that I've heard over and over again. And I know the NRA says claims they have 4 million people. I've heard so many people say they've given up their NRA memberships recently. I just don't believe those claims, and they're all self-reported. So, I think there's a need. And I think there's some groups that are forming that are here to represent, hunters' views. And I think the NRA is, sort of a dinosaur in that regard.
Isn't it strange that the NRA wrapped up its annual convention on Sunday before this happened? But at that convention, Wayne LaPierre fired up the crowd by telling them, "Today there is not one firearm owner whose freedom is secure." Are you and groups like you, Josh Horowitz, out to de-arm, take away the guns from all Americans?
No, of course not. That's just ridiculous. I was on a TV show last night, and the know-nothing, my debating opponent said that. And, of course, that's not true. I mean, I think that we are trying to, we would like to see a more restricted access to to handguns through licensing and registration that would weed out people who are not appropriate to have guns. And I think, your caller's response was great. I mean, handguns are used to kill, and we have to be very, very careful who gets them. But the other thing that I think was interesting about what you just said was how Wayne LaPierre talks a lot about freedom. And I think that people who care about our communities need to start thinking in terms of freedoms, too. Where is the NRA taking our freedoms away? And I'll give you a couple of quick examples. Right now, the NRA is pushing a bill in many states to allow guns, and they've already passed this in Oklahoma and Kentucky, a couple other places, to allow guns in the workplace, make employers, force employers to allow guns in their parking lots, in their own parking lots. And, of course, this is a historic assault on property rights, and business owners should be able to control their own property, and property is one of the core values of freedom. Another example would be the NRA's pushing these laws that immunize the gun industry from lawsuits. Now, they say they need that to protect the business, but the rest of us should be concerned because, of course, what that means is that people can't sue gun manufacturers for their negligence, and that interferes with our individual right to redress, our historic right to redress. That right has been around for 400 or 500 years, and all of a sudden the NRA is trying to take that away. So I think that the rest of our freedoms are in jeopardy. The NRA likes to push the Second Amendment like a sword and cut through all our other rights. I think we need to establish some balance. And I think it's important to remember that public safety is really our first freedom. Without that, nothing else is possible. And to the extent that that these liberal laws that allow people who shouldn't have handguns to get them, I think is a detriment to the rest of our rights.
Talking with Josh Horowitz, Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, getting his reaction to what happened on Monday at Virginia Tech University, and talking about the gun law debate that has resurfaced in light of that tragedy. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. 12 minutes before 8 o'clock, coming up after 8, we will welcome in Bill Bradley. You remember him, former basketball star, former U.S. Senator, former candidate for president. We'll talk about the ideas that he has in his new book, The New American Story, coming up after 8 o'clock. We are talking in this half hour with Josh Horowitz, Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He's talking with us about some of the issues in the news following the shootings, mass murders at Virginia Tech University on Monday. Our next caller is Richard in Menominee Falls. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, I guess I'm realistic enough about this issue to realize that there's no way in the world we're ever going to be able to stop all these guns. If I could, I would melt them all down, but that's never going to happen. So I think we have to learn how to live with these guns. But the thing that I find the most interesting about the advocates is the comment that they make about, you know, the self-defense issue. I think is such a fallacy, because a couple of months ago we had an FBI agent here in Milwaukee who got gunned down at a gas station. He was well versed in using that gun. He had the gun, and he had no protection to himself. So the full idea that if I carry a gun, I can protect myself, I think, is just it's a big ruse and not true at all. And then the last comment that the other guest made concerning these gun free zones. He makes a comment that in these gun free zones, the crimes go up. But you know what? Virginia has the most lax gun laws in the country, and here we had the biggest gun shooting in the United States history right here. So I think that all of these folks that are against these guns and fighting against these guns, I think they're delusional about how you can protect yourself. And quite frankly, I believe they're paranoid because they're afraid of society and they have to walk around and be armed. I just found it appalling because I truly believe they're delusional and paranoid.
Josh Horowitz?
Well, you know, I think there's some truth to that. I mean, the fact is that, you know, it takes a lot of skill and a lot of preparation to use handguns effectively in self-defense. And, you know, we had another tragedy last year here in Northern Virginia, where, you know, a shooter actually attacked a police station. And, of course, the first police officer responded with his firearm and was killed. Or she was killed. And it was a terrible tragedy. And you know, it took a bunch of police officers to subdue this gunman. You know, we know that guns make, you know, that more access to guns leads to more crime. And we also know that it's very difficult to use these weapons adequately in self-defense. That doesn't mean it never happens, but that means that to do it, you need to be well-trained, much more than the 12 hours that Virginia provides. And it's not in Virginia, you can get a concealed permit with 12 hours of training. That training includes no live fire, no accuracy training. So, you know, I think the idea that we're going to be, you know, able to defend ourselves and be heroes because we have access to a handgun is sort of a juvenile comic book type thing. I think the reality is that they're difficult to use, and I think the best thing here, and I think we need to keep thinking about this, is how do we prevent these from happening in the first place? That's the best remedy. And I think there's many signs here that could have prevented this killing, as well as making the weapons less lethal and less adapted to this kind of shooting. And I think that's really the problem here.
Yeah. But isn't it also the reality that if someone wants to kill other people or kill him or herself with a gun, that person's going to get his or her hands on a gun no matter what the laws?
I actually think that's, you know, not accurate. States that have got serious about this have made it much more difficult for people like that to get guns. And I think New York City is an excellent example of that. Massachusetts, California, Rhode Island, Hawaii have done a very, very good job of preventing access to firearms in their states. And I think that shows in the low overall death rate and the low homicide rate. So I don't think that we should be defeatist about this. I don't think we should say there's no, you know, anybody's going to get a gun. I think we live in a culture that says that's okay. I think we need to change that culture and say it's not okay, that the burden of proof should be on the purchaser, not the other way around. And I think that until we do that, we're going to see that these types of incidents are going to infringe our lives and our freedom continuously.
Let's go to Keith in Shorewood. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Joy. just wanted to quick point out that that John Lott's total fraud. Just simply go to the Brady campaign website, and there's a number of things about how he faked the study, how he claimed he did it at the University of Chicago. The University of Chicago has no record of it, and his partner in the study under deposition admitted serious fraud. But anyhow,
he's not the only person who says these types of things.
Well, I think your caller's making a really excellent point. I mean, I didn't want to dwell on this, but, you know, if you do any literature search, John Lott has been exposed as, you know, a complete fraud. He's, his research is faked, and he's done a number of other nefarious things that I think make him very problematic. And you know, as someone, if you look at some of the studies on this, the studies show that his conclusions are wrong. I mean, there's a great study by Ian Ayers out of Yale University and a number of other studies that take apart that data and show that it's inaccurate. So I think your caller's got a very good point there.
Mm-hmm.
The other point I wanted to make is that these assertions that gun crimes in Europe are going up. When you start with a very small number of gun crimes, you have a few that happen, you're going to double or triple your statistics. The other thing is, when you look at right-to-carry states versus states that restrict it, such as Wisconsin, just simply Google up the FBI uniform crime statistics. Take a look at Wisconsin, the violent crime rate. Our violent crime rate is half that of Texas, where they have very liberal gun laws, and I believe it's about half of that of Virginia. So this idea that you allow conceal and carry doesn't hold water if you just look at the overall statistics.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's accurate. I didn't listen the first hour, but did he make a claim that Europe is more dangerous? Is that the...
That's the claim they make, and they make it all the time on the blogs and the internet.
Right. Well,
they're just plain wrong.
I heard him saying that in Europe there were these multiple victim, shootings like we saw at Virginia Tech, too. But
You know what happened, though, I think, is there's two sort of these incidents that have seared people's mind, the Port Arthur massacre in Australia and the Dublin massacre in Britain. And after those, both those countries have seriously tightened their access to handguns, and they've seen their crime rate drop dramatically. And, of course, their homicide rate is dramatically lower. I mean, you know, something like 400% lower than the United States. So any claims that it's, you know, raised the crime rate, raised the murder rate, the NRA puts that out all the time, but if you talk to, I talk to people all over the world, especially there's a network of people who keep statistics on this, and if you tap into that, you'll realize that those claims that the countries that have made it harder to get handguns have an increased crime rate and increased murder rate are completely false.
Thank you, Keith. Aaron in Egg Harbor, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thank you, Josh, for keeping the fight going. totally against handguns and really guns in general, but mainly handguns. You hear a lot of people say it's not the gun, it's the person, but, you know, in reality it's the bullet, and what delivers the bullet, the gun and the person. So it's a cooperative thing, and handguns are bad. They're very bad, and they should be legalized, and I think the government should offer cash or things that young people want to get these guns out of their hands, and we should melt them down and make a big peace statue out of them.
Well, I agree with a lot of what you said. Handguns are made for one thing, and for killing, and we need to make it very difficult to get them. Just a note on the gun buyback situation. There's been a number of those tried around the country research perspective, they have not been shown to necessarily lower crime. I think, though, from sort of a community involvement, they're excellent ideas. They get people involved in the issue, get people sort of up to date on what's going on, and they build community around this issue, which I think is a very needed thing. I mean, the real question underlying that, though, is what will the government do about this? And, you know, I'm not really sure. I mean, I think that we've seen there's sort of a myth that the gun lobby beat Al Gore, and since then it's been very difficult to do anything with gun laws. I remain always optimistic in these things because I wouldn't do it if I didn't think I could make change. I just wouldn't do this my job. But I think that we all, if we want to make a difference here, we all need to call our legislators and push hard to make a difference here.
Yeah. One last call, Jim in Racine. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hello, it's, yeah, I guess I wondered how long this is going to, after the shooting, I wondered how long this is going to take until this debate came up. I'm a college professor, and I talk to my students. I run an interpersonal communications class. We talk about these issues all the time, and my thing is always to be prepared, and I know you think that this is kind of a comic book type of thing, but I would much rather die on my feet than die coward underneath a desk. I would much rather take my chances. I've been a responsible gun owner, handguns and the like, for 20 years, and most people out there are, you know. And I don't think, like your last hour, prohibition doesn't work. You're not going to keep people away from guns. You're not going to keep people away from alcohol or tobacco if they want it.
We have. I'm sorry. We have less than 30 seconds. Prohibition doesn't work, Josh Horowitz.
Well, I think. Look, I understand that. That's a natural reaction. The problem is that this person was, you know, quote unquote, a legal gun owner. You don't know who's going to snap. And I think the thing is that we need to leave the prevention. We need to do more on prevention and leave the law enforcement to the trained professionals.
Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Josh Horowitz is executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.